Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us this morning. The international story dominating the headlines this week has been the typhoon that struck the Philippines last week and the relief efforts that are related to it. It's also the first topic of conversation with World News contributor Art Sear today. Art, welcome back to Lake Effect. It's great to see you.
Likewise, Bonnie. Thank you very much for inviting me back.
Well, what's the story right now? How has the international relief effort been handled so far?
Well, the news emphasizes the negative and, in this case, really disturbing information about just how widespread the devastation is. The Philippines is a country that it's not as heavily developed and industrialized as just about all the rest of East Asia and Northeast Asia, as well as Southeast Asia at this point. So a storm this monumental is particularly devastating. I do think it's important to underscore, because I don't think it's mentioned enough, that in this case, as in others, whether it's within our own country or literally around the world, the U.S., spearheaded by the phenomenal technical capabilities, but also the humanitarianism of the U.S. military, not just the Navy, has been leading the effort to provide humanitarian relief. That's something that isn't mentioned enough compared to earlier periods in our history, especially during World War II and the Cold War. And I think for that reason, it's important to underscore.
Have international politics gotten in the way yet of any kind of relief efforts, or are we still in too early days?
That's a very good question. No, I don't think so. There is a very, very limited, in some cases, Islam-linked, radical, and violent set of movements, rebel movements in the Philippines, but they're of no particular consequence compared to the rest of the Islamic world and some other parts of the world. The Philippines is immersed in a complex array of territorial disputes involving mainland China, Taiwan, South Korea, North Korea, Vietnam, particularly because China's become so much more aggressive internationally, generally, including in maritime matters. There are a lot of disputes, and they involve the Philippines, but so far this is fortunately limited enough that the humanitarian disaster, no politics has so far intervened.
How do disasters of this magnitude then test diplomatic relations and international economics?
That's a very good question, and there's no easier or short answer, especially from an academic like me. But I think going beyond that, it does underscore indirectly the increasing strength of humanitarian cooperation around the world. I've been emphasizing the role of the U.S. government, but aid agencies generally, quite apart from government and business, is the nonprofit sector, which includes its educational institutions, religious institutions, but also nonprofit service groups. And those are growing in number, in scale, and the amount of capital that they manage and are able to attract worldwide. I'm responsible for the International Political Economy major at our college. I'm fortunate it draws good students. It also draws internationally minded students to an increasing degree. I'm very directly conscious through them, fortunately, of the range of service and relief organizations that in some cases have sprung up within the last couple of years. That's a very positive development that, again, tends to be underreported, because what makes headlines today or years ago is, you know, shocking, bad, disturbing news more than the good news.
Well, moving a little further west, Israel has been in the news just yesterday talking where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that he is scrapping plans that were put into place to build some major new housing in the West Bank. And meanwhile, the U.S. is in peace talks with the Palestinian Authority. Bring us up to speed on what's happening in Israel and Palestine right now.
Well, in lots of ways, again, beyond the news, I think Netanyahu and his very hardline but coalition government in Israel is under a lot of international pressure. Israel has a problem of isolation within the UN and the wider community of nations for bad reasons, but also some good reasons, I think. The Israel-U.S. partnership is extremely important. For many years now, Israel's extremely aggressive approach to building new settlements in the occupied territories has generated criticism, not only from Palestinians and Arab states and their sympathizers and allies, but also from the United States, certainly, even during the conservative Bush administration and comparatively pro-Israel Bush administration, and within the Jewish communities in Israel as well as the U.S. So I think he's reflecting that. Also the fact that his extremely hardline stance, and often very bluntly critical stance of the U.S. in connection with Iran, has indirectly contributed to isolation in Israel. So this is something they can do at virtually no cost that shows that they, in fact, are being flexible.
So how do you think that is going to affect talks with the Palestinian Authority?
Well, I don't think there's going to be any direct impact. I may well be wrong, and I'm hopeful that there's a lot going on behind the scenes that we don't know about in the public sphere. And with a talented, able diplomat like Secretary Kerry in office, I think that is the case. I do think that it is useful beyond the Israel-Palestine talks. There is a kind of de facto good cop, bad cop routine between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu. It's actually useful to Washington. I think that Israel is as hardline as they are. I don't think this is planned. Maybe it is, but I doubt it, because the American Secretary Kerry can always say, look, don't you want to be a little more flexible? Look what you're dealing with if these talks fail, vis-a-vis the Palestinians, vis-a-vis Iran, vis-a-vis the region generally.
Well, speaking of the region generally, let's go to Syria for a little quick recap. What is happening there?
Well, it's a very, very bloody and brutal armed conflict.
And that hasn't changed.
No, unfortunately. And the Assad regime is as hardline as ever, as far as I know. Rebel groups have become more flexible in terms of willingness to participate in peace talks, which may or may not go anywhere. Two points to keep in mind. They're by no means a unified or uniform. They're a very, very broad and diverse, not even a coalition.
You're talking about the
rebels.
The groups, yes.
Yeah,
okay.
In opposition to the regime. That's all that unites them. Also, I don't know if we should blame John Wayne or what. I do think it goes beyond any particular aspects of our culture. We're very comfortable, we Americans, in contrast to our European friends, in seeing the world in terms of good guys and bad guys. And just because the regime in Syria is populated by bad guys, that doesn't mean the rebels are good guys. I don't support the way President Obama has handled this in specific terms, but we've been extremely wise to be restrained and keep hands off in terms of any direct military involvement.
What do you see happening? More of the same for the next little while?
For the next little while, but over the longer term, we're dealing with a remarkable and historically extremely important movement toward democracy in North Africa and the Middle East, generally in the Arab states. For many years, Israel and Turkey were the only really reliable allies of the United States and the only representative governments. They're still the only really reliable allies, but increasingly, amidst all the turmoil and violence and retrogression sometimes, there is a broad movement toward democracy that is extremely important and very much in line with our own values and interests.
Talking about our values and interests, a few weeks ago, the world's media was alight with the news that the NSA had been eavesdropping on German Chancellor Angela Merkel, among many other world leaders. Was this as big a surprise as everyone claimed it was? And does that go against those values that we say that we have in terms of democracy and free speech?
It's a surprise only in terms of the extraordinary scope of this surveillance and comprehensiveness of this surveillance of our allies. I'm concerned about these revelations for two reasons. First of all, it reveals laziness, not of the usual sort. There are lots of people in the intelligence services, as in public service generally in Washington and abroad, who get up very early and work out and get to the office when the sun is rising and put in very long hours and send out emails and make phone calls and go to meetings. But this passivity, this passive reliance on electronic surveillance, I think, is potentially extremely dangerous and is personified to me by the arrogance as well as complacency that Intelligence Director Clapper demonstrated before Congress. And, of course, he's opened up a hornet's nest by so doing. Senator Dianne Feinstein, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and someone I admire a lot as a very effective leader and public servant and a sensible one, she is really going after our intelligence agencies generally, and rightly so, in order to rein in this kind of, in a way, lazy surveillance, in the sense that you're not relying on the messy, sloppy, often very, very distressing human agents who are essential to effective intelligence work. I'm very glad that Congressman Sensenbrenner from this immediate area, who spearheaded the passage of the Homeland Security Act right after 9/11, is spearheading an effort legislatively to rein in this pervasive intelligence activity.
Well, how realistic, though, do you think that is? I mean, once people get used to relying on that sort of thing, I would think it would be very easy for them to continue doing so and just not admit to it.
That might happen, but the cost will be very high. I do think it will have what's happened already will have a practical effect on the intelligence agencies of encouraging restraint. This analogy with a haystack and we have to do this to find, I think that's unpersuasive. I hope that starting at the top, which means the president, who is sympathetic to making changes, at least in an abstract sense, I think that going back to the old-fashioned way of more human agents is what we have to do in the future. And despite all the current mishandling and insensitivity on the part of American officials, it's interesting that while we're spying on the Chancellor of Germany, our most important friend in Europe, especially with the rise of Putin, we still apparently maintain the policy of not spying on the English speakers, not only Britain, but the Canadians, the Australians, and New Zealanders. And fortunately for us, Prime Minister Cameron in Britain has been remarkably circumspect and indirectly at least supportive of these foolish Americans in the intense debate in Europe.
So what is the diplomatic fallout, do you think?
I don't think the diplomatic fallout is particularly great. Clapper said it was like Casablanca. These European leaders are like Inspector Renault in the great film. They're being a bit disingenuous when they say they're shocked to know they're spied upon. I don't think it's going to destroy any current alliances, certainly not the NATO alliance. But I do think it means that the Europeans will be less cooperative, and specifically President Obama, who has problems even before this started with leaders overseas, is going to find himself more isolated and less able to get confidential and friendly and relaxed conversations with his counterparts.
Well, Art Sear, I thank you for another friendly and relaxed conversation with our counterpart. It is a pleasure to have you in, and we'll catch you next month.
Well, thank you, Bonnie. It's a great pleasure, and I want to thank everyone who's listening to our program, including perhaps the intelligence operatives of the United States government.
Lake Effect contributor Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business and the director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. Milwaukee's fine dining scene has changed a lot in the past 30 years. We'll learn how when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.